You're listening to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, our guest is Linda Connell, Director of the NASA Aviation Safety Reporting System. In the news, we have the European Aviation Safety Agency takes issue with pilot license renewal practices in Germany. The pilot's Bill of Rights morphs for medical requirements. ICAO creates a site for aircraft tracking and consequences for air traffic controllers who make mistakes. We also have an interview with the first woman cleared to fly the F-35A Lightning II and one of only 52 women fighter pilots in the U.S. Air Force. All that and more coming up now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 370 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and as always, I have a group of co-hosts with me. We'll start off with Rob Mark. He's a pilot, a flight instructor, an aviation journalist, and also publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hi. Oh, no, that's right. We were talking about Japanese before, and that doesn't actually mean hi. That's something else. Good evening to everyone all across the globe.
Absolutely. Also joining us as co-host is another Max, Max Trescott, Max West. He's a certified flight instructor, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max.
Hey, hello, everybody from sunny California. And I just got back a few minutes ago from the Palo Alto Airport where I was doing my thing. So any day I get to fly is a good day.
You have a lot of good days these days, I think.
Someone has to do it.
Someone does, yes. Also with us is Brian Coleman, our associate producer, fresh off the plane from Germany and somewhat jet-lagged. Brian, I hope you're able to make it through the whole episode.
Thanks, Max. Yes, I am lagging behind the jet, although I had something happen to me with, believe it or not, United at San Francisco Airport. And it got my blood boiling, so I might be able still to stay awake the entire show because I was so excited. So I clear through customs early. I walk over to a gate to get on a standby flight early. A service director is walking towards me, and I say, "Oh, it looks like the flight's closed." And she says, "Yes, it is. We have to leave on time." And me being fairly snarky, I respond, I said, "Well, if you landed on time, this wouldn't be such an issue." Yeah. And she walks away.
No response.
She doesn't say, "What problem do you have? How can I help? What do you mean?" She simply walks away from me. So I think United still has an issue with customer service.
Now, Brian, I would walk away if you said that to me in the airport, so I don't know what you expected from her.
No, but their job is supposed to be customer service. And again, I think it should have been something like, "What problem do you have? How can I help you? What do you mean?" I just, a non-recognition of someone talking to you, I think, is completely unacceptable.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree more. And of course, tonight, as we were just talking before the show started, everybody should go up to NPR.org. They did a great scathing report on United Airlines tonight. And they said, "United Airlines needs to improve its customer service." Gee, I felt like looking at the radio going, "Oh, you think?"
Wow. You know what I'm starting to think? You know how we kept talking about drones so much that David and I spun off another podcast solely on it. Right, maybe we need to spin off United customer service.
Rob and I could do
podcast.
A United show.
Wow, that would be a great idea.
Oh, okay. Man. All right. Well, we better introduce our guest this episode. It's Linda Connell. Now, Linda's director of the NASA Aviation Safety Reporting System, and she's a research psychologist for NASA Ames Research Center. Linda's been working at NASA Ames Research Center since 1981, and she's participated in a number of studies with domestic and international research teams that explore human factor issues and aviation environments. Linda, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. It's the first time that I've actually been able to pay attention to airplane gigs.
Oh, I hope it won't be the last. Well, at least for the next 60 or 90 minutes, we hope you'll be able to pay attention. We'll hold your interest. So
Absolutely.
Now, you're a pilot, also a registered nurse, and I understand you're a member of the AOPA, of course. Have you flown anything recently?
Not recently. I am one of those pilots that we all been hearing about that the FAA took their third class medical away from for really nefarious reasons. So I've been fighting to get it back for a long time.
Oh, well, maybe we have a news item coming up that touches on that subject. So maybe we can probe a little bit deeper into that issue.
And Linda, Max T here. I just want to let you know the last ground instructions session I did just about an hour ago, we were talking about your service and the forms that pilots have flown out, filled out for years and things like that. So very timely.
Oh, fantastic. Good.
Great. Well, coming up, we're going to learn all about the Aviation Safety Reporting System and what it means for aviation. But first, let's get started with some recent aviation news. So is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Yep.
Our first item comes from ReviewJournal.com. This is EU challenging Germany's air safety authorities post-Germanwings crash. Well, the European Aviation Safety Agency says that the license renewal practices for pilots in Germany tend to favor privacy over safety. Now, they note that Germany has addressed some of the concerns, but the EU says that they still have some issues. Also, if Germany does not comply with the Commission's demands, it could be taken to court. This is pretty strong. That's kind of the, well, one of the issues when you look at privacy and safety and what's the public right to know, health issues, things like that. And of course, we saw that with the co-pilot, Lubitz. In the Germanwings crash accident. So it's kind of a timely issue.
Well, and this is not new. This story about the authorities arguing with each other appeared not long after the accident. I'd say within maybe 3 or 4 days. I just think that because of the because of the size of the accident, and it was very spectacular, that issue kind of got lost. But this has been going on for quite a while. That people have been upset with the way the German authorities handled all of this issue with the Germanwings crash, and also some of the certification issues with German pilots in general. And one being what you just mentioned was that they knew certain things about Lubitz, but they let the privacy issues trump what we would have said should not even have been a discussion. Hmm. And that's kind of what the fight's about.
You know, we had kind of a similar issue here with a Colgan Air crash back in Buffalo. Was it 2009, flight 3407? And at the time, I guess the captain had failed some line checks at a prior airline that he flew at, but that information was not available to his new employer. And I can't remember the outcome, but I know they were talking about putting together a database so that airlines could actually share that kind of information. And I can see why, from a privacy standpoint, pilots wouldn't necessarily want to share that information.
It's tough because, privacy is governed by laws in different countries, and the laws are different. How do you do this across international lines maybe is kind of problematic. Linda, is this an issue that you run into in what you do?
It's not common that we hear about anything related to certification. It's mostly people who are certified that are reporting to the system.
Do we think this is a problem that's sort of specific to Germany, or is this more widespread than that? Is it a problem that you'd characterize as being widespread, or is it just kind of a question that's open?
Personally, I don't know how I would know exactly. I do know I have dealt with Germany as partners in different research projects, and that country has very, very strict laws about public discovery of information. And they even ran their experimental design for a reporting system out of for the EU. They were looking at Germany to hold the data because of those strong protections.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, Max, that's what I was going to add, because I actually work for a German corporation, and the privacy laws there are ridiculously strict and strong and support the workers. And we actually have problems or challenges getting German employees to come over to America and work on a project basis. They just don't want to give up those rights when they come over here.
Yeah, I know that we've read in the press how Google has had trouble in Germany doing mapping, because people don't want their, you know, their homes to be videoed, to be part of a geo map. So it obviously extends beyond just aviation. It's not just an aviation privacy issue. It's a broader issue. But you know, when it comes to safety, it's tough. I mean, if there's an issue with a particular pilot, a health issue or a mental health issue or a physical health issue that could have a safety impact, it becomes a difficult conversation.
Absolutely.
Let's move on to another story. This is from AvWeb. Pilots' Bill of Rights changes one-time medicals for some. Now, we've talked about the Pilots' Bill of Rights before. This was introduced earlier this year by Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma. And originally, it was designed, I think, to waive the third-class medical for private pilots flying light aircraft. But the bill has, well, it's kind of morphed. This article mentions some comments from the senator that talk about an online aeromedical course every 2 years. It talks about logbook entries that certify a pilot has seen their personal doctors at least once every 4 years, and if they need treatment for medical conditions, they've gotten it. And also a one-time medical for new pilots and pilots that haven't had a medical in the last 10 years. So you see some sort of shifting here. What do you think? Does this make sense? Is this a compromise that weakens the sort of the initial view of third-class medicals?
Yeah, I think somewhere along the line they've decided that to get more support for the bill, they needed to make some changes. There was a big pushback in July to get the bill as it then stood passed, and I know we talked about it on the show and encouraged people to contact their congressman. I actually got an email this morning from my congresswoman, Anna Eshoo, saying that she had just signed on to support the bill, which is great. I think the pressure from pilots has helped. AOPA reported that as of Thursday of last week, 67 senators, 140 representatives had signed on to co-sponsors for the legislation. So I think clearly they've added some things to the bill just to try and get broader support so that that it could pass. And you're right, originally basically all you needed was a driver license and you could fly an airplane with four seats under, I think, 6,000 pounds or something like that.
And I understand that the support for this seems to be bipartisan, right? It's both parties are, of those who are signing on as co-sponsors, both parties are pretty well represented.
Yeah, this does seem to cut across all sides. But, you know, they also have some discussion in here, relief on special issuance medicals. So, you know, Linda, I'm kind of wondering, do you know any details about that or how might that affect you?
I really don't know the details on in that. I'd like to see something a little more interactive. In my case, I put something down on the interview form that had just kind of been established with my doctor. I was being honest, and I put it down, and it was not longer than a week later the doctor said, I made an error. I gave you the wrong medicines. I went back to the FAA after they took my third class and said, "I really was a mistake, and there was no recourse to this. There was no avenue that I could settle this." They wanted, as a knee-jerk response, was 3 years of all medical reports from all physicians I had seen. That now I'm on the German side. That's a little bit much into my privacy.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So it would have to be a fight at that point. And that's just been a back and forth that didn't go anywhere at the moment. And I've been busy, so I haven't kept right on top of it.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing it says about special issuance medicals is that visits to a medical examiner, an aviation doctor, would no longer be required. So I guess they wouldn't require, you know, you running back to an FAA doc every, you know, every time there was another change in paperwork. So that would obviously reduce the burden a little bit.
Okay, let's push on to another item. This is from Aviation Safety Network. ICAO starts aircraft tracking information web page. So the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, have created a web page to serve as, they call it, a repository of documents related to aircraft tracking. And this, of course, comes from, well, several accidents that we've had where either it took some time to find the aircraft, like in the case of Air France 447, or in the case of Malaysia Flight 370, never found or hasn't been found yet as we record this. And so there have been a lot of conversations, a lot of activity, a lot of proposals related to tracking aircraft. And ICAO has created this page to sort of capture all of that in one place. I guess it's kind of interesting. What do you guys think? Does this have a lot of utility?
I guess not. I was actually waiting to see if someone else was going to jump into that.
I guess it's interesting to know the timeline. I mean, the thing, it starts with Air France 447 on June 1st, 2009. The next entry is the Malaysia 370 in March of 2014. Then it goes on to the creation of an aircraft tracking task force by ATA in 2014 and so on. There are a number of links to documents and things associated with some of these. We'll put a link to the webpage in the show notes. It's kind of a long, complicated URL to follow, but we'll have that in the show notes if you're interested in following up on that.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry, Rob. Are they planning on doing just commercial aircraft or civilian as well? Or and how inclusive is this? Mm. I couldn't tell.
The goal essentially was to be able to track commercial airliners anywhere. That was the goal. And what kind of prompted some of the kerfuffle last week was that while some of the groups thought that was a noble cause, others said, well, yeah, but wait a minute. There are a lot of commercial airplanes in the world that don't have the technology to transmit their positions on ADS-B. And if we require that of everyone, we could have aircraft sitting on the ground that are perfectly good airplanes to fly but just don't have ADS-B, and isn't that going to be a mess? And somebody said, oh, yeah, I never thought of that. So essentially, it's not a bad issue that they're dealing with, but that is one of the technology problems that's jumped up that they just don't seem to have quite figured out. But ICAO said, well, we still believe we should go ahead with this. And again, that's kind of the kerfluffle issue at this point.
Well, the proposal is what? That there's a 15-minute aircraft tracking standard? Isn't that what ICAO is looking towards?
Right. Correct. And some of the carriers are saying that to produce that is technologically difficult for some carriers. Hmm. Some airlines already have all the equipment on board, and to them it's like, who cares, right? But it's the guys that don't have that equipment yet that are concerned, because it's going to apply. I'm not sure at what point, you know, the aircraft will be selected to either be included or excluded, but they're still saying that it's not quite ready for prime time. And to Brian's question, general aviation airplanes are not going to be included in that. Business aviation aircraft typically don't want to be tracked.
Right.
You know, when McDonald's goes to Mumbai, they don't want anybody to know that McDonald's G5 went to Mumbai. Not that it would ever go to Mumbai, because they don't eat beef there anyway. I don't think, do they? No.
And not because they're going to do anything, evil when they get there. It's for competitive reasons, right? You don't want your competitors to know where you're going, because then they can, you know, divine what you might be up to.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway.
Well, I guess ICAO is looking to, as I understand it, issue a standard sometime by the end of this year. Now, I don't know what kind of implementation timeline they might be looking at. But, you know, if it comes out and says, yeah, over the next 20 years, aircraft will comply with this, then that gives people, you know, time for the fleet to refresh with sufficient, you know, hardware capability to do this. But if it says that, you know, by the end of 2016 that, you know, everybody has to comply, then that's got that problem that you were just talking about, Rob.
I don't know what that date is.
Yeah.
I should look. But again, it's way sooner than the airlines would like to see. But again, they're getting pressure all over the world from people who fly in the back seat that say, what do you mean I'm flying on Air Cubana at over Mumbai and you don't know where I am? What do you mean you don't know where I am?
It's hard,
you know,
to explain
people,
to someone.
People just are outraged at that somebody on the ground doesn't know where they are all the time. But yeah. Unfortunately, that's the way it's been for a long time.
Okay. This next story, I think this came from a listener, and I forgot to make note of who it was that sent this in. Oh. So.
Actually, I sent that along.
So it came in from Max Treska.
Exactly.
Did it really? This is from the TV station in Houston, KPRC TV in Houston. Air traffic controllers making major errors remain on job, including at IAH, which is George Bush Intercontinental Airport in Houston. So basically, this investigative reporter says that, quote, air traffic controllers who have made major errors have been allowed to stay on the job without loss of rank or pay, and that this has occurred not only at the Houston airport but at other airports as well. And the reporter, Joel Eisenbaum, asks, this is a question, he says, so you can make an error that causes a plane to crash and you're not losing your job? So I know I had a pretty strong reaction to this. Max T, what did you think when you saw this?
Well, that's why I forwarded along. Initially, I sent an email amongst our show hosts just saying, hey, is this something we should talk about? And I thought it was interesting that the reporter asked, you know, can you give us an example of any time when any controller has ever been fired, you know, for failure to do something correctly on the job? And I'm sure there probably have been cases, and of course the FAA did not respond, but it did kind of raise the question of, you know, could you, you know, stay on forever, or how bad a mistake would you have to make? And the, you know, this particular example in Houston involved an aircraft that crashed with four people on board when the controller who was supposed to be relaying weather information didn't and wasn't wearing his glasses as he was required to, and so on. I mean, I don't know that there's a clear case that you could say, yeah, the accident was directly a result of you know, his negligence. But they did talk about an accident where it does seem a little clearer that the controller may have been directly involved, and that was a mid-air collision that occurred over the Hudson River a few years ago between a plane and a helicopter when an employee at, I think at Newark, as I recall, was you know, supposed to be monitoring and instead was talking on the phone with his girlfriend, and it was about something crazy. They were talking about like roadkill or something just ridiculous, and he got transferred to you know, another airport in Virginia and still is working. The only case, and Rob, maybe you can share some cases you worked as a controller where one has actually been fired. The only controller that I have ever known to have been fired was here at the San Francisco Tower, and it wasn't for air traffic control release reasons. He had this nasty habit of, on his lunch break, robbing banks. So not only did he get fired, he went to prison. True story, probably about 10 years ago. He was actually a supervisor for San Francisco Tower. And, you know, I guess that was his hobby, and it caught up with him.
Wow.
I know of an interesting one that happened in Chicago at a tower where a controller who essentially lost his mind had an abuse issue, and he beat his wife up one night and locked her in a trash can in one of those self-storage places up the road from the airport and Wow. left her there. And they found her the next morning, luckily. It was very cold, so she had some frostbite, but otherwise she lived. And the controller was indeed fired, although I don't think it was for an ATC issue. Mm. I think it had to do with the fact the guy was nuts.
Yeah, that sounds that way.
Yeah, I think whenever you commit a felony, your job should be at risk.
Yeah, that's an easy one.
The one thing that this article didn't talk about, though, is what type of additional training do the controllers have to go through when they make a mistake? And
certainly
it's tragic when they make a mistake and lives are lost. But
yeah, this gets to the way I react to this, which is that almost no problems are caused by people. Most problems are caused by process. You know, it's a problem with the process. If it's a problem with the person, like they're unstable or they don't have the skills and are incapable of learning the skills, it's still a process problem. It's a problem with the hiring process. But other than that, when something happens, what you want to do is understand what's the process issue that allowed that to occur. What was the process that allowed the guy to be on his phone during working time, you know, with his wife chatting about, you know, whatever? Maybe that's a training issue. Maybe there needs to be other changes so that that's not possible. So to me, if there's an accident that occurs as a result of something an air traffic controller did or didn't do, then what you look at is the process that that controller is involved in, and how can that be mistake proofed? And that's the way you look at it. You don't just fire somebody every time they make a mistake. I mean, if everybody got fired every time they made a mistake, we'd all be unemployed.
I'd have a new job every week.
Yeah.
Well, I have to kind of chime in on this one because we had an interesting report, and it just brings back the perspective of how you're going to make people accountable. Kind of thing. In the ASRS, we received a report from a GA pilot, and he described quite clearly that he went out for a night flight in the Chicago area. He took a friend along with him as a safety pilot, and they lined up and they were working together to land, and they landed and they thought they were going to Midway. They actually landed in ORD. And it all looked the same. And if you look at the map, the runways are lined up exactly almost to compass. So, because of prevailing winds, they got on the ground, looked around, saw big hangars and big airplanes, and they went, yikes, we're in the wrong airport. So what did they do? They taxied back, took off, never talking to air traffic.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, many years later, I was presenting this in Oshkosh as an example of some interesting snafus that can happen in the system. And a guy came up to me later, and he said, that was Chicago in March of 19-whatever. And I went, yeah. He says, I think I was there that night that happened. And a trainee was on the boards, and we pulled him off and retrained him because he obviously had made a mistake to allow that airplane in.
Right.
It wasn't the air traffic controller's fault at all. These people had never – they were communicating with Midway. They were doing all the right things in what they thought was the right direction and ended up in the wrong airport.
Well, you know, I think it's one of the hallmarks of aviation, of the aerospace industry, as to how problems are dealt with, treated, root causes identified, and some kind of changes made so that, you know, they don't happen again. And to me, this is, you know, sort of another example. This is what the aviation industry does really well. And, I think this reporter kind of goes a little too far in suggesting that, you know, really a lot of these, you know, bad actors need to be fired. I just don't see it that way.
Yeah, but he does end the report with, in cases of, my monitor just went dark.
willful neglect dereliction
of duties. An employee, you know, the appropriate measures will be taken, which, you know, can include termination of their job. And I think that's great. And I think, Max, what you're saying is a little bit of investigation needs to be done first and understand what the issues are before you actually immediately terminate someone.
Right, because you don't want to fix the problem just for that individual. You want to fix the problem for everybody. And that's not oftentimes that's not individual specific.
And of course, one thing that we're dealing with too these days is that there are safety management systems that are coming into play at the commercial airlines, at business aviation flight departments, at fixed base operators, at airports, where they are trying to come up with a system that reports the slightest screw up. And I don't mean necessarily a human screw up, but anything that could even remotely be a safety issue so that it can be shared with other people so that they can see trends long before they become an accident.
Yes.
And if you penalize people, and I'm not saying that in the case where lives were lost that I'm saying, hey, the guy should have gotten away scot-free. We don't know enough about it to be able to say that pro or con. But the point is that if you penalize people for sharing information, they're not going to share anything. And right. Here in the States, we have gotten to the point where we think that there is much more to be gained by sharing information about issues than to be lost. I mean, let's face it, that's Linda's job right there alone at ASRS is to grab all these reports from people where pilots and controllers and mechanics and, you know, ground personnel get to say, well, hey, here's what happened. And we're basically saying that unless you had some criminal intent, you get a pass on that one because we want to know what happened so that we can hopefully prevent an accident.
Exactly the underlying premise of 40 years of work under this aviation safety reporting system.
All right, we're going to get to that really quick. In fact, let's sort of wrap up the news segment. One item, this is from Kansas.com. Textron Aviation customer wheels up, completes capital raise. We talked about Surf Air in a previous episode. This is another company that is wheels up, that is has an order for, I guess, 105 Beechcraft King Airs, don't they, Max T?
They do, which is a phenomenal number. Surf Air had an order, as I recall, for like 57 Pilatuses, both of them membership airlines focused in different regions of the country. And what's interesting is Wheels Up just completed a $115 million capital round, raising funds. The company is valued at $500 million, and they have orders on the books for $1.4 billion worth of airplanes.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's kind of, you know, you think maybe the cart's a little before the horse. And you'd also think that their cost per seat's going to be significantly higher flying twin-engine King Airs versus the Pilatus. So it'll be interesting to see how all these players shake out as eventually they grow and start to overlap in each other's regions.
Hey, Max, what I don't understand, they're talking about the King or they're talking about their expansion into Europe, which would be great doing a membership airline for that. But just looking at the map, Boston to London is 2,800 nautical miles, where the King Air's range is 1,200. They're going to do a fuel stop in Iceland? How are they planning on getting there?
Yeah, they've also purchased 10 refurbished Citations. And I don't know whether they're actually talking about doing membership for people within Europe or actually from Europe to the U.S., so I don't know.
Oh. Yeah, maybe within Europe.
Okay.
And then one last item in honor of David. David wasn't able to make it this episode, but we have a tanker item. This is very exciting. The Boeing KC-46A first flight took place from Payne Field in Everett, Washington. So a milestone in that program.
Yay, first flight. We need some applause.
A four-hour flight. Obviously, this is, it's the first flight, but they'll be running a series of flights. They're going to look at deploying the refueling boom and the wing aerial refueling pods. I guess that's up next. Actual refueling, of course, is farther down the line. So good news that the KC-46A program is progressing. Again, we're speaking with Linda Connell. She's the director of the NASA Aviation Safety Reporting System. Linda, again, thanks for coming to the show.
Well, you're very welcome. This is very interesting.
Yeah, we like talking this stuff, and we like learning about new stuff. And we have talked about the ASRS, I think, from time to time, sort of tangentially. I always have trouble with that word. Tell us a little bit about what the ASRS is all about and where it came from and the history of that.
Sure. ASRS really was one of those events in history that was begun many years before. In fact, reporting systems, is the military had several of them in place, and there's still one today in the Navy called what they called AnyMouse, which is a bit of take on anonymous. But it really wasn't for commercial aviation. Didn't even kind of get thought about seriously until 1974, when there was an accident in near Dulles. It was a 727 on approach to Dulles Airport, and they hit Mount Weathers in a controlled flight into terrain accident. In kind of the investigation of that by the NTSB, it was discovered that United Airlines had had the same chain of events leading up to the accident. They had had an incidents before, only they missed the mountain. They also had better weather than the TWA 514, and they were actually able to see this mountain and miss it. Now, I don't know if 50 feet is accurate, but it's kind of in the lore of the story, but that is certainly what began the whole industry looking at accidents in general, and why are we always going to the scene of accidents and hearing that people knew this would have happened or could have happened. And that is when the FAA administrator, I have to give a lot of credit to, said that we need to do something and capture information before the accidents. This is in the incident realm. And how are we going to do that? So he actually set up a reporting program at the FAA in May of 1975. However, very soon after, the industry came back to that FAA administrator and said, if you're really serious about getting incident information, things that happen short of accidents, you really cannot be the agency that runs it. You're the agency that's the accountability authority agency that holds the certificate of pilots, and no one will report to you. It's just the nature of human nature that people would hesitate. So that's when the industry group stood up and said, you know, NASA's been standing up a human factors aviation research department at NASA Ames Research Center in California, and they've been doing work with United Airlines on doing some internal reporting systems for United. If anybody does this work, we should certainly consult with them. And that administrator went to NASA at that point and asked NASA to develop what they thought would be a good system to meet this kind of mandate to gather information in a confidential manner. Four people around that table at that time developed the ASRS, and it was a medical doctor, Dr. Charles Billings. It was John Lauber, who's one of our former NTSB board members. It was a test pilot with NASA, Gordon Cooper, who was involved in a lot of the workload rating skills of Cooper Harper. And it was also a gentleman from headquarters who was kind of overseeing this whole effort with the FAA. That program got developed in 4 days over a dining room table, and it virtually is the same today as it was back then.
Wow. Don't you love it when things come together so well, you know, just right from the start?
Yeah, wait, this is a government program that
this
happened with?
This is a government program. I know. I think of that.
How'd
often.
How'd that happen?
Hey.
Yeah.
And the best part of this is that administrator had to take on his own agency. There were so many different lines of business against this idea. And he said, not only do we need to do what these people at NASA have proposed, but we will provide immunity to the people who use it and report. And then the lawyers at the FAA were up in arms. And he made it through all of that gauntlet to actually make this happen for everybody. And to this day, I really give him a lot of credit for persevering through all the bureaucracy.
Kind of a
and
visionary.
And that's when NASA, yeah, it was vision. He grasped the vision. I think others had the vision as well, but he really was able to help it become a reality. So we ended up with a reporting system that you and I can use every day. And it is voluntary. It is not mandated by anybody to report. It's confidential, and because the FAA has offered the immunity, it's non-punitive.
So, Linda, tell us a little bit about how the process works. Who can submit reports, and how does that process work?
Okay. Anyone that's flying in aviation can submit a report. It's really meant to be people who have two eyes in the system. It originally kind of got rolled out and emphasized to pilots, but it was always available to everyone in aviation. So if you look at the beginning, it was mostly airline pilots looking to protect their own certificates and their careers and livelihoods. But over time now, we've really been able to bring in a lot of new groups. And we now have reporting from the pilots, the air traffic controllers, maintenance, flight attendants, dispatchers, ground and ramp people, and even once in a while, FAA, FISDO, and flight service have put reports in as well. Once in a while, I get a passenger report. It's really not intended for passengers unless they have some kind of major safety issue. Now, if I get a passenger report from someone who's a certificated pilot, I pay attention, even though they are sending something in because they were riding in an airplane. It's relevant to me. It has some credibility immediately.
Linda, so, do you also get the kind of reports where, you know, people submit something like, you know, I see chemtrails over my house?
It's rare that they find us, and I'm not sure why that is, but there have been occasional reports.
Yeah.
I've also had this airline lost my luggage. So,
but that's not the intent.
It's not the intent, and it's a really low-level report that comes in. But now this system, with everyone kind of in the game and participating, we're running towards 95,000 reports a year.
Wow. And so this all goes into a database, and what happens with the data?
Well, we are looking at every report as it comes in the door. So I have former airline personnel, pilots, air traffic controllers, maintenance technicians on staff. And they read every report. In fact, it's two people that read it. They are my expert analysts. And they decide, is there safety content here? Is this a report that we should alert the nation immediately and internationally as well? Is this a report that we would never want to lose track of? It's got a great educational value. Is this a report that is part of special studies that we have ongoing at NASA and collaborative agreements with the FAA? They make those decisions as they come in the front door. Now, not all the reports get fully analyzed. They're evaluated immediately. And then a certain selection of those go forward for full analysis. It's kind of like looking at a rushing river flowing by, and you're panning for the gold nuggets. We're looking for the gold nuggets. So some of the data going through is kind of typical, usual. We have a lot in the database that it's online for the public, but we're continuing to look for the gold nuggets. And we do a pretty good job of that, I have to say. These analysts are very dedicated. They know what to look for and how to pick up on it.
It's interesting that you use the term golden nugget, because that's actually the exact same term that we use in the corporation I used to work for when it comes to collecting data that leads you to process improvements. But
right.
When these nuggets are identified, who then does the analysis? Is that part of the ASRS organization, or is that farmed out, or who does the work?
Well, NASA really from the very beginning determined that if they were going to hire highly qualified, retired, or highly experienced people that didn't want to work full time, we had no way in the government to put somebody on an hourly kind of wage, part time and that kind of thing. So it was determined that having a contract mechanism with NASA was probably the better avenue, because then you can craft that to be very specific to the application you're requiring. So from that point on, we've always had a contractor. The contractor, I live basically with the contractor, because there's just so many nuances to assuring confidentiality and protections, issues that arise every day that need my attention. But they are performing the work, doing the report processing. The report processing is unique in terms of some other data collection systems. These are not data handlers. These are the experts in aviation. They are the first people to see it. They are the last people to see it. They provide that qualitative reliable analysis of the data. So what you see off of our website online that any of you can search under many, many different kinds of topics you might be interested in, that has been verified, validated, qualified by these experts. So it's really good data in terms of looking at things. However, it is not trend data because it is highly selected.
Max Trescott or Rob, have either of you submitted to this database in the past?
I have from an event that happened, I don't know, many years ago to me. But it's nice to know that you – it's not something you can use all the time. And, you know, if the people at the Gore organization say, oh – It's Thursday. There's another report from Jim. Then you know that something is certainly wrong. But again, I've only used one once in my flying career, although I was thinking of a second one here not long ago. But that actually brings me to a question, Linda. How long do you have from the time of a situation that needs a comment until the NASA report no longer would be valid? Or is there a time limit?
There really isn't a time limit. We might get it all depends on the way the case – we do a case-by-case analysis. So some cases are real obvious, and then others are coming in later that add a little more picture to the puzzle. And now we go back and we grab this data from before and bring it together to try to build the final completed picture of what's happening around any one issue. So it's living data, quite literally, and it's driven by corporate memory of our analysts, but also by the way we can search the data. So if we've identified something that needs to go out nationally and internationally as an alert, we will then go back and look through the data to see, is there anything in there that helps support this issue, helps people understand the full context of this issue. So it all goes forward again. So it's a lot of that going on with this data.
Now, I had a student pilot who filed one earlier this year, and she had an issue where she didn't correctly comply with an instruction at the runway. My recollection was she was instructed to hold short, and she kind of thought she was instructed to line up and wait, which meant she went out on the runway when she wasn't supposed to, and another aircraft had to go around, and that resulted in her filing a report and her having some interaction with the FAA. What I was told at that time by the local flying club that she was a member of, and this is kind of wondering if you can validate this, Linda, they said that she had up to 10 days after that incident to file that report and still be able to benefit from, the FAA not being able to pursue, certificate action and things like that. Is that true? Is there a time limit as to how long after an incident you have to report something to still be afforded the protections?
Yes, it's in the FAA Advisory Circular 0046E ECHO. It explains the 10-day window, they call it. And it is meant to give people time to get a report into the system and describe the event that they experienced. And it's from the moment you recognize the problem. For instance, pilots tend to recognize these issues very quickly in real time. Maintenance people may work on a part and put it on a shelf and it doesn't get put into service for 3 years, and they don't become aware that they made an error till much later down the time continuum. So they have, 10 days from the time they're aware of the error.
Well, and there's something related to that, that the club said, go ahead and file it now and don't expect to hear from the local FAA inspector until at least 10 days go by. And essentially what the club was telling her was, they're not going to want to tip their hand that these protections are available to you. And so often they will wait 10 days before calling. And sure enough, that was indeed the case. So I guess, pilots out there, if you think that you're off scot-free because you made a violation and you didn't hear from somebody in 10 days, that might not be the case. You might still want to file your form.
Well, part of the argument I would give a pilot is, were you aware that there was a violation? Yes, you have 10 days. If you weren't aware there was a violation, there was no indication, and it wasn't until the FAA contacted you, that's when the 10-day clock starts. Okay. So it's a combination there for people to understand. If you're aware, this is why I always say submit often, submit frequently, because you never know, actually, sometimes what the consequences might be. But if you're aware that there was some inadvertent violation or inadvertent entry into anything or a safety situation of some kind, the sooner you get it in, the better. The system is trying to react to those safety issues and not at, because of any one person. We realize it's an interaction between a human and the system.
Linda, I know that there's a really great presentation on the ASRS website that kind of describes the entire program and kind of walks you through the elements of it. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. I think it's very helpful, very instructive. But a piece of that I noticed that I wanted to see if you could talk about a little bit about is the sort of the alert process. So what are the circumstances under which you you issue an alert, and where do those go? Who receives those?
Our analysts identify the reports that they feel have some alert capability, that it's either a new issue or it's an old issue again revisited, or maybe it's an old issue with new description. It's something that says, if I were an authority out there or I was someone working in safety, I'd want to know about this one. And we've managed to select, we don't do it frequently. I mean, this is only about 300 a year out of 93,000 reports that get selected for alerts. But anything the analyst sees that is strictly some kind of problem for safety, like the next step to an accident or something like that. We have two levels. One is an alert bulletin, and that means we have a lot of information around this topic, and we're moving it forward to other people. For your information, notices might be more like a windsock at a GA airport that's completely destroyed or something, and the state aviation department doesn't know about it. So we move in those kind of two directions, the highest hazards and the more low-hanging fruit of type of hazard. But they are determined by the expert analysts. They are worked up by the expert analysts. And we forward them to the office or organization that we feel could most quickly take corrective action, because we don't do corrective actions. In NASA, we're an unbiased, neutral organization, and so we're just trying to get information in people's hands. And then we wait. We also copy to just anyone else who might have a touch on this problem. So AOPA gets a lot of our GA ones, if not all of them. If ALPA, ICAO, depending on the nature of the alert, will get copies. And we're trying to get everybody in the conversation about this event and what it's kind of possibly indicating as a tip of an iceberg to a larger problem.
Interesting. How many analysts are in the organization, and where do you find them? Where do they come from?
Right now we have 10 part-time analysts for aviation, and they are coming word of mouth from people who retire in the Bay Area from all the major airlines. We've got most often our maintenance analysts have come from United Maintenance Base at San Francisco. They have to retire. They cannot have current connections with any major airline. It's a conflict of interest. We love it if they have GA background and they're flying on the weekends, or they've done other kind of work with military aircraft, et cetera. We're looking for broad-based, high hours experience in our analysts.
And are these paid positions or?
Yes, they are paid positions. So what typically has happened is an airline pilot either maybe is medically disabled and comes our way, or they're retired and they're still wanting to be involved in aviation. These are highly dedicated people. They stay with us for a number of years. And I'm always amazed at the work that they can provide for us.
Well, the website it's got four parts to it. It's ASRS, which stands for, of course, Aviation Safety Reporting System, .ARC, that's got to be Ames Research Center.
Correct.
.NASA.gov. So it's ASRS.ARC.NASA.gov. And Linda, is that where folks go if they want to submit a report?
Yes, there's electronic, secure electronic report submission. capability there, as well as getting a form and printing it out and filling it out and put it in the mail. It's what everyone is comfortable with. Some people still are a little unsure about sending electronic information to the government. So we still have a healthy flow of paper reports coming in the system, and I'll always accept them. I don't care if it's on the cocktail napkin of your after flight briefing. It's important to get the information in the system.
Sure, sure. Data drives everything.
Yes.
Are there any directions that ASRS is going in, or is it kind of continue on on the path that you're on?
Well, this path that's been able to be replicated across 40 years is pretty robust.
Yes.
The FAA pays for this program. I don't want to neglect to tell everyone that they pay the bill on this one. They send it to NASA, the monies out of their budgets, to operate this program. So we're under kind of constant review by the FAA and how to best measure the value of the program and the dollars that are sent to us. So we're always trying to hook our data into other efforts. Like it goes now into the FAA's SIAS program, which is the Aviation Safety Information Analysis Center. It also connects with the NTSB, SMS, in the commercials, the ASAP programs, are all being kind of trained on how to come onto our public website, or call our office and get information and data around maybe safety topics they're dealing with in their companies. GA pilots are encouraged to come into the database. Your fellow GA pilots have submitted reports on that airport you've never been to. You can learn from what their experiences were going into those airports. So there's many ways to keep using this. And I think that's where I keep my eye, is not to get too distracted off of that kind of goal, getting the most data I can into the public database. We want this to be as transparent in safety as we can make it.
Is there a newsletter, something called the Callback Newsletter?
Yes, it's called the NASA Blue Sheet for some reason, because early years, it was printed on blue paper, and it's the NASA Blue Sheet. So it is called Callback, and we've since had to discontinue the mailing. It was so expensive. So it's now all online, and you can sign up to have a subscription, and we'll let you know that when the next issue is posted and actually deliver it to your mobile if you want it that way. So it is meant to capture a few of the things we've seen come through the system in that month, bring some visibility to maintenance in one issue, to general aviation in two or three of these monthly newsletters, or in the commercial area, looking at NAVAIDS and RNAVs and some of the new next-gen technologies. So it depends on what that topic for the month is.
Yeah.
My editor gets creative and occasionally does a "What would you have done?" And that's been really popular. We put an actual report up, and it usually is talking about a pilot getting into a dilemma of some kind. And it ends with, "What would you have done?" Hmm. And you have to turn over the piece of paper to find out what that pilot did.
I love that idea. That sounds like a great way to engage pilots and others, but also to learn something about how people might approach situations like that.
Right. I've done those myself as I'm reviewing these before they leave. And I go, okay, this is what I would have done. And I turn the page and I go, that isn't what they did. So do I need to either learn something new, or this is something I don't want to do?
Yes, that's clever.
You kind of have both sides of that coin when you're reading these. Yeah. So this Halloween is coming up. We'll probably have some spook journal. Our editor loves to get into that.
Good. Love it. Well, Rob, what do you think?
I think NASA's, I'm sorry, I always call them NASA's ASRS Blue Sheet because I'm so old, that's what they used to be.
They were.
Oh, no, I said it.
You did.
I have just always been amazed at the things that, and I go in there maybe once a month, maybe twice a month, just to read the stories online because they go, oh, wow. I thought I was the only one that did dumb stuff like that, but we all do, and we don't do it on purpose, of course. But we're people, and we screw up, and it's just nice, I think, to see other people make the same mistakes we do, but to read about people who share things that some of us can look at and say, whoa, I never even thought of that. That's really the part that I really enjoy the most.
And I love the ASRS database. I just want to put a little spotlight on that because I think it's such an important resource. I think a lot of pilots are very familiar with the NTSB database. Folks that are safety-oriented will go out and do data searches of that. But I think far fewer of them, you know, think to go and mine your database because, you know, you've got certainly even more information because there are 10 times as many accidents that didn't happen. And there's a lot of good research material in there.
Absolutely. And there's a search engine on our website, and you construct your own search. There's a tutorial if you want some suggestions on how to construct those searches. But if anyone has any issue that with the site or has trouble finding the information they're looking for, there's a contact us drop down on our website. Send in that request to us. We have people on staff that will basically tailor the search for you and talk and send it to you. So, you know, this is meant to be accessible, and however we can make that happen, we're really supporting that.
Linda, being the non-pilot of the group, I get to ask the dumb questions every once in a while. Is this U.S. only or is it international?
Well, this ASRS is U.S. only at the moment. Although, if I have a Lufthansa pilot arriving at LaGuardia and he says, I know about the ASRS, I'm sending a report in, I will get foreign pilots sometimes, you know, sending in information. But this model that was developed, like I said, over a dining room table has gone out worldwide in aviation and in other domains. Like medicine and railroad. I'm actually running the National Railroad Reporting System for our country at this moment. We're rolling that out to the railroad carriers. It is all modeled around the same ideas of ASRS. So then in aviation, there are 12 other countries that operate reporting systems. So we meet annually to talk about what kinds of things they're hearing about in these other countries. And if we come up with an issue we haven't heard about, we might fire out to the other members and say, what have you heard on this new one? This is a brand new one. And then they come back with information about what they've seen in their country. So it's an international collection of these reporting systems.
Well, actually, I have one last question, Linda. Does this immunity system that we've all been, you know, so privileged to have over the years, does this need to be renewed every couple of years to keep it going? Or, I mean, should we ever worry that there's a threat it could be yanked out from under us?
Well, one of the things as a program director, I have to watch carefully is the balance between the two agencies and the aviation community to make sure that it is working to everyone's interest equally. We know for a fact that if we don't have industry support, there's no reports coming in the front door. So it's a very sensitive issue of keeping that trust in place. And government agencies have other agendas and need to follow through with taxpayer dollar reviews and this kind of thing. So sometimes we get questioned about the effectiveness of the system. The advisory circular is an FAA document that offers the immunity. Now, it has no renewal time frame that it needs to be done in. But if something new comes up, the FAA will then come out with maybe a new one. Now, whenever they do, it goes in front of the industry to be reviewed. So there is some control over, you know, making too many dramatic changes to the system without everyone having some feedback to that change.
Yeah, if they broke the system, it would probably be a loud hue and cry from the stakeholders.
Well, and that happened in the 80s. One of the FAA administrators says, what is this program? These people are getting, quote, out of jail free. There will be no more of this. We're taking the immunity provisions away from the program. And that was a human outcry that was really amazing. Went all the way to Congress. Congress came back and basically said, you will keep your hands off a good program. And you will continue to pay for it. So it was kind of a critical moment in time where it really got laid out as the value of this program is really greater kind of than the sum of all of its parts. So I hope that continues.
You know, we often talk about different government organizations. I have never heard a bad word said about NASA by this group. No, are they not our favorite government organization?
I know. Well, yeah, NASA's great, and NTSB is great, too.
Yep.
Yeah,
for sure.
Definitely.
For me, this is the first time I've really heard about a program like this being run out of Ames. When I was there, I worked an awful lot with the people that ran the wind tunnels. So it's just great for me to hear that you guys are doing other stuff as well.
Oh, many things.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Brian had to leave
I love working for NASA. It's a great organization. And that's why this aviation reporting system is sitting at NASA. It's the research and development organization, kind of a white hat organization.
All right. Well, Linda, thank you so much for a great conversation. Very informative.
You're
welcome. We really appreciate it. And again, the website is asrs.arc.nasa.gov.
Thank you very much.
David was unable to join us this week, but last weekend he attended an open house at Joint Base Andrews, and he recorded a couple of interviews. The first is from with Lieutenant Colonel Christine Grinder Mao. She's the deputy commander for the operations group of the 33rd something or other. I can't read David's notation. There's too many abbreviations here. The important thing is that she was the first woman to be cleared to fly the F-35A Lightning II, and she's one of only 52 women fighter pilots in the U.S. Air Force. So let's listen to David talk with her.
This is David Vanderhoof at Andrews Joint Base Andrews. I got to change my language after all these years. And I'm here with Lieutenant Colonel Christine Mao, call sign Grinder, the op group deputy commander for the 33rd Fighter Wing. And Lieutenant Colonel Mao, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure to be here.
And Grinder, I won't call you that for a moment, but you have the privilege of being the first female pilot qualified on the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, otherwise known as the Lightning II.
That's what they tell me.
So what's it like to fly?
It is awesome. It's a super fun airplane to fly. I love it. I've been flying it now for about 4 months. I've got about 40 hours and 20 some odd sorties.
And how many hours in the sim before you took to the skies?
So it's tough to remember exact numbers, but I think it's between 14 and 17 simulators for about 25 hours or so.
And does it fly like the simulator when you taxi down the runway the first time?
It really does. The sim is a very accurate representation of how the airplane flies.
So tell me a little bit about your career in the Air Force. We have a lot of women listeners who want to learn, begin a career in aviation, and you took the Air Force route. Tell me a little bit about your career.
So I joined the Air Force, I guess you could say, in 1993 when I went to the Air Force Academy, straight out of high school. At that point in my life, I just knew that I wanted to fly fighters. So I took whatever steps were going to increase my odds of becoming a fighter pilot. So I graduated from the Air Force Academy in 97 and was selected to go to Euronato Joint Jet Pilot Training at Shepherd Air Force Base. So I went through that in 98 and got a fighter out of that and flew Strike Eagles for about 15 years. And then came over to the F-35 in March.
What was your transition like from flying large F-15s to smaller Joint Strike Fighters?
Well, the mission is very similar. The airplane flies a whole lot different. And the most striking difference is there's one engine versus two, and there's a single seat. So in a Strike Eagle, two engines, big airplane, carries a lot of bombs, and I have a backseater. And that's great. That jet was designed for that. This jet was not. And so it's the automation, the way things are mechanized, is in such a way that it makes it very easy to fly by yourself without a wizzo in the back. The most striking difference between the two mission set-wise is the stealth, and I've really enjoyed that. It brings us a huge advantage to the battle space, being able to enter fights unseen or target the enemy before they even know you're there.
And what do your ground crews think about the aircraft?
Well, you can ask them. There's a few of them around here, but what I've heard them say to other folks is they like it. doesn't break as much as legacy airplanes, so they're not turning as many wrenches. So if you like to turn wrenches, that's somewhat of a disappointment, I understand. It's an electric jet, so we have a lot of avionics issues, as you might imagine with any electric jet. But what I've heard is it's very easy to maintain, especially the stealth. It's an advancement from what I've heard on the F-22 in maintainability.
You don't get that shiny paint all over your airplane like the F-22s.
No, it looks pretty cool, though, doesn't it?
It really does. It's sort of, I'm still, hate to say it, but, you know, even though I'm an Air Force brat, I'm kind of partial to the Charlie with the bigger wing and the beefier landing gear. I just don't know why, but just that's from the looks. So when are you guys going to go operational?
We are currently scheduled to be IOC in August of next year.
That would be initial operational capability, folks, if you don't know what IOC is.
That's correct.
Well, what would you like to say to all of our women listeners about becoming a fighter pilot?
So the biggest thing I want to say is don't ever limit yourself. A lot of folks maybe don't see themselves becoming fighter pilots because there just aren't a whole lot of women. I think there are only 52 of us in the Air Force right now, so we're less than 2% of all fighter pilots, which is kind of weird. I don't know why that is. I would encourage women to do this. It's a fun, rewarding job. I have loved every second of it. I couldn't imagine doing anything else. But what I see in a lot of young bucks and does is that they just limit themselves because they don't see themselves doing it, perhaps because they don't see people like them doing it. But I mean, the military is a meritocracy. The world is your oyster. Anything you want to do, if you set your heart to it and you try hard enough, you're going to do it. So I am nothing special. I've just had some goals and been really tenacious about going after them.
Well, thank you for taking the time for being on the show, and thank you for your service, and thank you for bringing a beautiful jet to our country.
You're welcome. Fly safe, airplane geeks.
All right. Thanks, David. David had a wonderful time at that event. I spoke with him afterwards, and I want to thank David for bringing us that interview. I think we'll push on, and we have a recorded message from our friend Micah, our main man, and he sends us his thoughts on the late Alan Perwin. And so here's just a short recording that Micah sent to us.
Alan Perwin died in a plane crash on September 11th, 2015. It took quite some time for me to find out about it. Hearing about his death makes me feel awful. So awful, in fact, that I need to tell you about it. So who is Alan Perwin, you ask? Really? You don't know? Well, I'm not surprised. I didn't know either until I read the obituary from the Los Angeles Times that was reprinted in the Portland Press Herald. Alan Perwin was a pilot, an entrepreneur, and a philanthropist. According to the obituary, he started flying at 5 years old when he had to prop himself up on pillows to see over the instrument panel of his father's Cessna 182. He got his fixed-wing certificate at 16 and later his helicopter license. Eventually, he founded and acquired many companies, including Helinet of Van Nuys, California. He was on the board of directors of Children's Hospital Los Angeles, where he donated a helicopter and offered transportation services to many patients at no charge. Most of his companies were involved in either flying or developing equipment for aerial cinematography. And not just live flying, UAVs too. You've probably seen some of his work. It includes the Transformer series, Armageddon, Pearl Harbor, and the 2003 remake of The Italian Job. Remember that aerial footage through the tunnel? That and over 100 other films was Alan Perwin. You didn't know any of this? It's okay. Like I said, I didn't know it either. And there's no shame in not knowing. But there is a question. You see, it seems to me that Alan Perwin was a terrific pilot. And based on all I just read about him, probably a pretty terrific person, too. Yet I never knew of him to appreciate him while he was with us, before he died in a Piper Aerostar that crashed on takeoff in Colombia. And although well-known and respected in his area of expertise, to most of the world, he was staff, not line. So unless directly involved with him, there was no way for us to know him. Yet we all knew his work. That's not really fair to him or to us. So I guess the question is this. Who else are we missing and not appreciating while they're with us? Alan Perwin, I'm sorry I was never able to thank you for the great action scenes that thrilled me, nor for the ones I'll see in the future thanks to the equipment you developed. But I thank you now for giving me the opportunity to appreciate all that you did. For the Airplane Geeks in Portland, this is your main man, Micah.
All right. Thanks for that, Micah. Let's see, Brian, returning from Germany. You're still awake. You're still with us, Brian?
Barely. I'm hanging in.
All right. Well, when you were over in Germany, you met one of our listeners, Hendrik.
Yeah, I did. It was great. We took a tour of the harbor, and as we were walking around looking at the beautiful Hamburg Harbor, talked airplanes and what I thought was going to be, I don't know, a half hour, hour long meetup ended up being about 4 hours, and just had a great time. And I'll be back in December, and we made plans to go on a tour at the Hamburg airport. So really looking forward to going back. So everyone says it. It's really true. We have some of the best listeners on the planet, and this just shows yet again what a great group of listeners we have. And I did a little recording, and hopefully you can play it now.
All right, here it is.
Hi, I'm here at the Hamburg Harbor with Airplane Geek listener Hendrik, and he's been so kind to take me around and show me the city and talk about airplanes. So, Hendrik, can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Thank you. Hey, Brian. I'm Hendrik, and I work for an airline, and I live here in beautiful aviation city Hamburg.
How long have you been working for your company?
Well, I've been working in the IT department for about 4 years, and I'm very much enjoying it, processing all the tickets.
So now whenever I have an issue with my ticket, I know who I could talk to get my... Or actually, could I talk to you to get my refund processed any faster?
That's one of the things we do, yes.
Yeah, now if you could only fix my window seats where I actually have a window in my window seat, that would be great, but that's a different story altogether. No, I've been having problems with getting seats that's billed as a window seat, and there's no window.
There's no window, yeah.
Yeah, that's fun when that happens. Yeah.
Well, you should not fly the United to San Francisco. You should fly A380 because they have even economy seats on the upper deck these days. And they're very nice economy seats with extra room. But don't tell anyone.
So the upper deck economy seats have a greater seat pitch than the lower deck?
No, but you have a little bit more room to the side also, because usually they have the business class installed on the upper deck of the Lufthansa A380.
Oh. So it's the curvature of the of the aircraft.
It's a little bit better, although you can't lean your head against the edge so much anymore because the curvature is further away.
So you just have to pack a extra thick pillow to do that.
That'll work.
Yesterday, although no listener stepped up to take me on a personal tour of the Airbus facility, I actually went on the regular paid-for tour, and that was really a fantastic experience. Got to walk underneath an aircraft, well, several aircraft being built, and had a really great English-narrated tour of the facility. So that was a lot of fun. So, Hendrik, you've been on the tour as well?
Yeah, I've done the Airbus tour myself as well. Although, as you said before also, you didn't learn much new there from the actual narration, but it was really fun to be down on the floor and right there by the airplanes. So it's really great, yeah. And it's I hear it's a good place to work as well. When I was in 10th grade, I actually did a little internship there for 3 weeks, so... Right now, there's Alitalia and Air Canada and an Air Canada plane where I actually set some nuts and bolts in there. So, and I guess they're still flying today. Yeah.
Oh, so that has your handiwork in it.
Yes, from when I was 16 years old. Yes, and that was good fun.
Wow, well done. If anyone's been on the Boeing tour and they're over here in Germany, can highly recommend going on the Airbus tour here in Hamburg. So, Hendrik, anything else you'd like to say to the listeners?
Well, we have lots of great aviation things over here in Europe as well, so you're always invited to come over and experience aviation in Hamburg. And, for example, at the miniature Wonderland, which is actually a huge model railway exhibition, but it also features a fantastic little airport where planes take off and land, and ground vehicles come and surround the airplanes. So maybe you can put a link to that somewhere. And it's really a fascinating place.
Yeah, there's. I saw a YouTube video talking about it. And is that actually the Hamburg airport, or is it a made-up airport?
It's officially not the Hamburg airport, but all the buildings are exactly modeled after the Hamburg airport. And the Hamburg airport was highly involved in setting this up.
Okay, the sponsor.
Yeah, to some degree.
All right, so this is Brian Coleman, associate producer of the Airplane Geek, signing off from Hamburg with our listener, Hendrik.
Thank you. See you soon.
All right. That's cool, Brian.
An awful lot of fun. Hendrik's a great guy and really looking forward to getting together with him in December and continuing our airplane conversations and going on the museum tour-ish type thing at Hamburg Airport.
Yeah. Now, I've been to the Boeing plant several times, and of course it's so impressive in terms of the size. I mean, it's just a gigantic thing. You must have found the same at Airbus.
The actual facility, the square miles of facility is really amazing, but there's a bunch of different buildings. And unlike at Boeing, where they build the aircraft from start to finish or assemble the components from start to finish in one building, they'll actually move them around from building to building at the facility in Hamburg. So you have a very different perspective. I couldn't believe actually being so close to the aircraft. And every once in a while, our tour guide would have to say, "Don't touch that," which doesn't always give me a great sense of confidence over the planes that are being produced there. But the quality checks that they go through, our tour guide was a retired, he spent, I don't know, almost his entire career at Airbus. And he was a shop floor manager, and his level of detail knowledge about the place was really fascinating. And we ended up going about 20 minutes longer than what the tour was supposed to, because he just wouldn't stop talking about, explaining everything. And it was really great. And being, again, so close to the equipment, it's just something that you don't do at Boeing. I almost got run over by a forklift, and
that hurts usually.
Yes, I would have been skewered.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really, really neat.
But Brian, there is one thing. I hope you listened to Henrik's initial suggestion to you about not flying United.
I knew it was coming.
I thought that was kind of cool the way you worked that in.
Oh, yes. Now you guys are going to blow any chance of getting the United CEO on this show, you know.
I know it's...
No, this is a perfect opportunity for him to win us over.
Oh, there you go.
I would love to have a conversation with him.
All right. Let's move on. We've got, a couple of shout-outs. You found some interesting things, Max T.
Oh, so the item that I posted was related to our episode back in June when we were talking with, and I can never say his name correctly, though he's a local guy here, Einar Envildsen, who is associated with the Perlin 2 glider project. We had him on as a guest. He talked about getting gliders up to extremely high altitudes in Argentina. Anyway, the first flight of the Perlin 2 occurred this week up in Bend, Oregon. So we'll put a show note there on that. And the other item wasn't mine. So who put that up?
Nobody. So yeah, this is about this video, Mount Helena Airport in the South Atlantic. Who put that in there? Going.
Not me.
Maybe that was me.
I was in Germany.
I'm sitting. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. You know, as I started talking, I said, oh, I'm on mute. I guess I wasn't on mute. but no, that was me. And I just thought that was kind of cool when I watched it. Having watched the approach into Sabo last month down in the Caribbean, this looked almost as cool. I don't know. This was pretty interesting, too.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that video in the show notes as well. All right, moving on to some of the listener mail we received. This is just a small sampling of the mail. Also, apologize, I'm a little bit behind in it, having been gone for a period of time, including at a drone conference with David, which was very exciting. But the email is kind of backing up. This one is from Alan, and he says that he lives in Scotland. He always wanted to fly. When he was 16, he went to the RAF recruitment office in Glasgow. He wanted to become a pilot, and they turned him down because he wore glasses. And so he says, the next two decades, I've thought of the pilot career on and off again. And he says he's got the bug for it. But he says now he's got a family, a mortgage. Becoming a pilot as a career seems a million miles away, he says. With the help of your podcasts and Rob Mark's Jetwine, he says, I'm hanging in there a bit better and not giving up on the thought of being a pilot. So he has a question. He says, the UK have a dismal amount of scholarships and bursaries to help people become pilots compared to what the States have. Pilot careers being a global industry, would I be eligible to apply for a for stateside bursary or sponsorship without having to do the training in, say, Florida? He says, I travel a lot and the long journeys are made a lot easier listening to the Aviation Geeks podcast. Thank you. He says, keep up the good work, blue skies and happy contrails. So, Rob or Max T, any thoughts on sponsorship, stateside sponsorship?
Yeah, get in line.
Yeah.
Seriously, and I don't mean to make light of that you know, the question, but there really isn't any sort of sponsorship that I know of. In fact, the ones that seem to be occurring are happening outside the United States. You remember our friend Srinand from what, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and we met up at Oshkosh, and he was flying for Singapore, and he had started as a cadet with Singapore right from zero time. Of course, now he was an Indian citizen, and so that obviously helped, but the point was that they covered all the costs. And all he had to do was to agree to work for them for, I think, another 8 years or something like that.
Right.
After he finished the training. But hey, now what, 4 or 5 years later, he's in the right seat of a 777. Hmm. And so, but those kinds of sponsorships are few and far between, unfortunately.
And I think those kinds of things are generally state airline sponsored. So, you know, if you're in Singapore, for example, and want to work for Singapore Airlines, and I've just chosen them as an example, which might not be accurate, you know, they might go ahead once they hire you, send you to the U.S. and, you know, send you through training. They get you 250 hours of training and then, you know, put you in the right seat of whatever aircraft they fly. I know a lot of the airlines from India will do that. Short of that, I really have not seen any scholarships that are going to put out. We're probably looking at $75,000, you know, to get someone to 250 hours. Most of the scholarships I see are much smaller and much more, you know, targeted. There was a directory that you could buy off of Amazon that listed well over 100 scholarships that are available here in the U.S., but many of those would be for, you know, $5,000 or, you know, something like that. So, no, there really isn't a program that's going to generate large scholarships. And I would say a lot of folks end up, you know, taking out loans. Yeah, there's no easy way to do it.
And I think a good resource for questions like this is Carl Valeri's Aviation Careers podcast. So that may be something you want to check out. I think there's a good – you mentioned a directory on Amazon of scholarships available. That's probably the one that Carl maintains, which is a great resource. So maybe we'd point you in that direction as well. We heard from Matt. Matt sent us a link to a video that's kind of interesting. It was taken with one of those automobile dash cam video cameras, and just sitting at a light, waiting for the light to change, and coming at, from left to right on the cross street is a Piper Cherokee landing in the roadway. So it's something that you don't exactly see every day. I also don't recommend landing your airplane on a heavily trafficked road, but maybe there was no choice here.
I used to live about 2 miles from that intersection.
Is that right?
Yeah, I know it very well, and I could not imagine a plane landing right in front of me.
Sounds like a lot of luck, including the fact that he had a green light as he went through the intersection.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I don't see the outrage. I mean, the guy had the light.
Yeah, what's the problem? I got to say, that was one of my favorite videos. So I encourage everyone to go to the website and find the link, because it's definitely worth it. It's just so funny. Cars pulling up into an intersection. You know, you can just imagine the music playing in the background. And, oh, what was that that just drove through the intersection?
Yeah. Something else.
Yeah, it reminds me of the YouTube video where the made-for-internet movie called 405, where I believe it was the 747 landed on the 405 freeway. Yeah.
We received a photo from Michael. As you know, we asked you to send in photos that you've taken from your plane, of your plane, you and your plane, anything interesting, send them to us. And this is a view, a nighttime view, maybe a twilight view, looking over Los Angeles. That's got some nice sky glow going and the lights from the city below. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. I just noticed, you know, I looked in the photo and there's like a little dot, a little bright, I thought it was a star up there, but I see now that Michael says that that light is actually a 777 going into LAX. So interesting shot. And then Steve wrote us, we talked about the Good Traveler program last week, and he works as a consultant actually for the San Diego Airport Environmental Affairs team. The Good Traveler program, as you recall from last week, is designed around getting airplane passengers sort of involved in environmental support. But he sends us some links. There's a Good Traveler blog that we'll put a link to. He also says that they're experimenting with social media to build the program, and they have a site that's art.thegoodtraveler.org, where they have a contest going for a T-shirt design for the organization. So I want to thank Steve for passing that along to us. All right. Well, I think that's just about it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Linda Connell, director of the NASA Aviation Safety Reporting System. Find them at asrs.arc.nasa.gov. Let's quickly tell our listeners where they can find us online. Max Trescott, let's start with you.
Yeah, I was just thinking, could we cover more stuff in one show?
I know. Certainly, really, yeah.
There is so much. There is so much going on in aviation. It's really exciting and just kind of fun to go through all this. So thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us for another week. You can find me at places like maxtruscott.com or g1000book.com, or go to Facebook and look for Max Truscott.
All right. And Rob Mark, how about you?
Well, they just put in Jetwine somewhere, and they will find me, I think, and Scott Spangler. And I am always just so appreciative of the fact that we seem to have so many people around the world with nothing better to do with their spare time. Thank goodness for that. Because if anything really important comes along that sucks the energy out of people like some incredible new hobby, we're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah. All right. And let's see who's left. Brian Coleman. Sorry, Brian. How do folks reach you?
Yeah, I'm still not being social, so the best way to get a hold of me is at brian@airplanegeeks.com. And anyone that wants to either suggest a guest, although we are certainly backlogged for a little bit, but I'm keeping a running list of that, or if anyone wants to listen to all the back episodes, I can certainly get them a copy of the back episodes. So just send me an email. We'll get it taken care of.
That's great.
I don't even want to listen to all the back episodes.
We've already so much great content there.
Oh, yeah, dear. But what about the front ones? Okay, never mind. Okay.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me here. You can find me at the UAV Digest. I mentioned David and I attended the UAS Industry Days. That was at one of the FAA UAS test sites in upstate New York. We've got a lot of great content to go along with that. Find us at theuavdigest.com. You can also find me at the PaxX podcast. That's PaxX.com with Mary Kirby. You can find us at AirplaneGeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at AirplaneGeeks.com/370. You can find us on all the usual social media places, Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio. The email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We want to thank Brother Love for providing opening and closing music. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely. Keep the blue side up.
For my intro, I have even a better story.
Oh, cool.
Well, maybe not better, but it's personal.
Is it short?
It just happened. Yes, it's short this time.
Is it shorter than last time?
I'm positive it's shorter this time.
Okay.
It will not be in the top 10 format.
It was like 12 minutes before we got to the news. It was like a 12-minute intro last time.
A lot of firsts happened to me. I'm sorry.
Uh-oh. I think you can make something out of that. Should we try?
I don't think that whole thing actually recorded.
I'm just happy we have the news bumper back. I mean, that makes my day. No, I really like that thing. I really do.
Yeah, that's the original that Courtney put together.
Okay, so here's a contest for everybody. We could tell listeners that we want someone to vocalize the news bumper. And send in your recording of people going, dun, 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 dun. Who knows what we might get?
Yeah, we might have some actual talent out there, you know?
Oh, I don't know if I'd go that far. let's not push it.
We could try it.
I think we need to close like, what was it, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, that NPR show, the Car Talk show.
Yeah.
You ever heard like my brother?
Yeah, they always have this great close where they, you know, have the crazy names of people that are made up, you know, like our lawyers.
Right.
Our law services by Dewey, Cheatham & Young, you know.
I thought it was Dewey, Cheatham & Howe.
That's probably it.